Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Lorenzo Vedino and Seamus Hughes, director and deputy director of the Program on Extremism at George Washington University.
In this episode, we talked about their new report, ISIS in America, From Retweets to Raqqa.
And after the interview, we'll have an updated hashtag social media segment that will be covering postings from November 30th through December 7th.
American involvement in jihadism is nothing new. It goes back to the 1980s with individuals joining up for the anti-Soviet jihad in Afghanistan. That said, compared with Western European countries, the phenomenon has not been as large, even with the current growth of the Islamic State sympathizers and foreign fighters. At the same time, compared with Al-Qaeda and its branches, as well as past foreign fighter mobilizations, what we're seeing now from American jihadis is unprecedented. To talk about this, I have Seamus Hughes and Lorenzo Vedino on the pod to discuss a new report they did, ISIS in America, From Retweets to Raqqa, the first holistic look at this. To start off with, you know, a lot of what I do on my podcast, I think, you know, besides just providing more recent details, I think it's important to contextualize what's going on. So even though this isn't specifically in the report per se, I know that you have knowledge of this. So Seamus, I was wondering if you could maybe provide some context and a brief background on the American jihadi scene, maybe over the previous decade before we saw the rise of this sympathizers and individuals joining up with the Islamic State?
Sure. So I think the homegrown jihadist scene has been slowly ebbs and flows depending on the year. And I think it raised to prominence in 2007 to 2009 when you had the cases, a number of individuals from Minneapolis, two dozen, who went to join Al-Shabaab in Somalia. And then you saw a smattering of people that were kind of called and drawn to Al-Qaeda and various different affiliates, mostly to go overseas, but also some domestic plotting.
So getting into the report itself, Lorenzo, can you talk about the main statistics that you guys found and the key demographics of these American jihadis that have either gotten abroad or the ones that have been arrested at home?
Yeah, what we did for the study, part of the study was looking at the 71 cases of individuals who've been charged with ISIS-related activities since March 2014. That's when we have the first case, ISIS-related case, at least in the court system. So we went through the documents, we supplemented that with interviews, we tried to make sense of the demographics here. And of course, we did some you know, the usual quantitative analysis of this, and also obviously some, I would say, even more interesting qualitative analysis. What we found is that the vast majority are male, 86%. Although if you then look at the scene online, on Twitter, the ISIS sympathizing scene, I think you have a much larger number of women. The average age is 26, although I would argue that if you take out some two or three cases of people in their mid to late 40s that kind of skew the numbers, then the average age goes significantly down. We're talking about mostly kids in their early 20s, with a lot of people actually who are 19, 18, 19. Very geographically dispersed. The cases are in 21 states. We heard, of course, from the FBI director just a couple of weeks ago saying that they have 900 investigations open in all 50 states. So this is very widespread. And we don't really have clusters in terms of major hubs. You have 13 cases in New York. That's the largest number. 11 in Minnesota, but you really have cases all over the country, from east to west. Quite a few cases in the south, a few in the Midwest. So it's all over the country. And basically, what we also saw is that the majority of people at least tried to travel abroad. The trend has been for American jihadists to try to join ISIS in Syria and Iraq. And only 27% were involved in plot. Again, that's a number, though, that one needs to sort of analyze further, because a lot of these cases were sting operations. So true, they were planning, but partially because they were prodded by the FBI. That's sort of a bit of a quantitative analysis that we did.
So Seamus, I was wondering maybe if you could talk to us a little bit about the Americans that actually made it to Iraq and Syria, sort of what they've been up to while they're there and what their roles have been in the Islamic State.
Yeah, so really it's a spectrum in terms of their roles in the Islamic State. You have the case of Abdullah Pizarro, who was from St. Louis. He gets his citizenship and then a week later travels overseas and essentially becomes a mid-level commander in ISIS. And then you have the other cases of, you know, Ariel Bradley and Hoda from Alabama, who kind of essentially get into the life that is Raqqa, and, you know, they marry people over there, jihadist fighters over there. It really runs the spectrum. I thought the most interesting, one of the most interesting cases in the report is Saeed Kodamati, who essentially goes over and goes to Aleppo, you know, becomes the media arm for the local media arm for al-Nusra. And then ISIS comes over and takes over the area, and he then becomes the interlocker between the two groups. He's over there with his father and his brother. His father gets injured in a firefight, and Saeed is also in battle there. And he comes back to the States and gets picked up for false statements to the FBI. I think it runs the spectrum between, you know, people that are just over there to essentially be part of the so-called caliphate, and then actual fighters that are on the front lines.
Yeah. Do we know if any Americans are any, you know, at least mid-level positions, or are they all more lower level and foot soldiers?
No, we have a couple of cases of people who are who had a mid-level position. I think Pizarro, the case that Seamus mentioned, is one. Pizarro was a Bosnian who lived in the States for almost 20 years, became a U.S. citizen. Went back to Bosnia briefly, then went to Syria, and he rose to the rank of Emir of Akhatiba. So he was fighting directly under Omar al-Shishani, and it was pretty prominent. He had a Khatiba of mostly Bosnians, or anyways, people from the Balkans, and he died in Kobane fighting, and he's glorified in Bosnian jihadist media as a pretty senior guy. Kodaimati, the name you mentioned, is pretty prominent. At some point, he becomes the middleman between Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS, at least in the Aleppo area. He was from a pretty prominent family in Aleppo, so probably because of that. You have then a bunch of guys that became suicide bombers. They're quite glorified in media. I mean, obviously, that's more of a foot soldier role, but they're clearly part of the structures. We did identify, I mean, we did find quite a few guys who identify themselves as Americans, or anyways are identified with the Al-Amriki kunya, which, you know, obviously it's difficult for us to fully verify they were Americans, but that's obviously a very good indication of that.
Yeah, definitely. Do we have any good idea how many Americans are still in Iraq and Syria right now?
That's the million-dollar question. So the FBI says 250 Americans have attempted to or have traveled to Syria and Iraq. 71 people in the legal system. That leaves you about 180 or so, 179, that are kind of in this at-large or legal limbo. They're either back in the States, they've died over there, or they're still there. So it's kind of an unknown.
Who would you say is the most prominent American that's still over there? Are they two small beans right now, probably?
Yeah, I think that's probably
yeah, I think what's different, and I don't know what it says necessarily about the American ISIS scene, you don't really see these prominent American jihadists who are there and are online, active and doing propaganda from there. Like, you have a lot of, like, British, Dutch, Germans, French, who are there, and they are in your face, you know, propaganda, you know, putting out constant information about what they're doing, issuing threats, you know, thinking of there's a dog in Germany, individuals like that. You don't really have Americans like that. I have no doubt. I mean, we know that there are Americans there, but no public personality that is so open, so brazen there and talking to people here and issuing public statements. We're not aware of any of that. I don't think nobody really is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it could just be an issue of trust potentially, or paranoia, just because they are American. And unlike the European networks, which a lot of those people have been in the milieu for years. A lot of these Americans coming out of nowhere. So that might be part of it too. Turning to more of the online aspects of this, since obviously everybody loves this part, even though it gets overplayed a little bit, I think. Could either of you maybe explain what you talk about in your report about the three roles that American individuals play on Twitter, the nodes, the amplifiers, and the shoutouts?
Sure. So I'll go over a little bit on the social media part, and then I'll kick it to Lorenzo to talk a little bit about the physical world, because relationships do matter in this. And you're right, they do. We tend to overplay the social media aspect of this. But at the end of the day, you know, if you know somebody who's over in Syria and Iraq, you're more likely to be enticed to go over there. So in terms of social media, we essentially looked at 300 people we believe to be Americans on social media, primarily on Twitter. And they separate into three different categories. The first one was essentially the nodes, and they're the ones who are essentially the prominent part of the propaganda. They're pushing out, you know, new content. They are essentially the place where everybody goes to get what they need to know. The second part is essentially the amplifiers, and they're the ones who are pushing the propaganda. So they're retweeting, they're constantly making sure that the new videos get out to the followers. And it's not quite clear from our research, you know, how many of those people are actual people or that set up bots. I think the data is a little bit hard to parse on that. And then I think the final one, and I think the most important one for the system, is something called the shout-out accounts, or what we term the shout-out accounts. And it builds a level of resiliency into the system. So these jihadists are routinely kicked off of Twitter and social media for violating terms of service because they're, you know, glorifying ISIS or they're pushing, you know, violent images, so they're violating the terms of service, but they're shout-out accounts that are announcing their return, which would build a level of resiliency in there, and you're able to get some of your followers back on these type of things. It's the way they're able to continue to be on Twitter and Tumblr and places like that.
If I can add my two cents here, I think we're all in violent agreement here, but the whole social media aspect has been overplayed to some degree. There's no denying that it plays a huge role. I mean, the role of the internet with terrorist groups, I mean, it's something that has been studied, and it's clearly very important. And with social media and ISIS's ability to exploit it, what we looked at, for example, is three different ways in which social media works for Americans in ISIS, whether it's the radicalization phase, whether it's the mobilization phase, or actually even the phase in which we plan attacks. Garland, the attack in Garland was a great example of that, where you had the people who planned the attack, who carried out the attack, talking on Twitter with people in Syria and Iraq, in ISIS, literally minutes before carrying out the attack. So crucially important role of social media. Having said that, from some accounts in the media, you would think that if we didn't have Twitter, if we didn't have social media, we would not have ISIS, we would not have radicalization and terrorism, which is obviously not the case. So I think it's a spectrum. You do have some cases in the States of individuals whose radicalization is solely, only, exclusively online. Yes, those cases do exist. I think you have some individuals, particularly they live in small towns, do not know any like-minded individual in the physical space, and all they do is being active online. Then what happens in some cases is that the FBI steps in, does a sting operation, but these are people who have never, you know, pledged allegiance to ISIS, are very active, and then eventually get charged with material support, but they really never met a like-minded individual in the physical space. So, but that's one extreme of the spectrum, and you do have quite a few cases like that. But then you have cases that are more about the physical space, where, of course, they have a presence online. Like most people in 2015 have, they're active on social media and so on. But their online life is complemented, supplements their offline activities. And in many cases, the offline one is more important. So we mentioned, for example, the case of Pazaro, the cluster of Bosnians there. These are people that knew each other from their hometown in Bosnia, Teslic. They're all somewhat related to one another. And those relationships are more important than the social space. Same goes for the cluster in Minneapolis, the Somalis there. Yeah, of course, all of them are also online. They have Facebook profiles, Twitter accounts, and so on. But they know each other from school, from the neighborhood, and so on. And those relationships are arguably more important.
You also have the ability to use the online space to, like Lorenzo said, to complement the physical world in terms of logistical support. So we saw a number of cases where individuals were online and talking to their friends that were in Syria and Iraq and getting contact numbers of recruiters. So when they landed in Turkey, they knew who to call. They got step-by-step guides to know what to talk to when they get to the customs officials to be able to cross the border. So you see that kind of logistical support being used online.
Let me close with just one quick thing. Just continue the comparison between the US and the European scene. Social media, I think, is more important, generally speaking, in the U.S. Than in Europe. Because it's such a small scene here in the U.S. And on such a large territory, it's much more difficult for an aspiring American jihadist to get in touch with the real deal, with like-minded individuals, and to mobilize. If you are if you want to fight with ISIS, if you're an aspiring jihadist and you live in Belgium, in France, and in London, in Birmingham, it is pretty easy to get in touch with the real deal through personal networks, through certain personal connections, which are not that difficult to develop in the physical space. If you live in Mississippi, if you live in some rural town, but also in some big cities in the U.S., it's much more difficult to get in touch with like-minded individuals and with people who are facilitators that will allow you to get in touch with ISIS and so on. So you do have to rely much more on social media. But having said that, it's not just about social media.
Yeah, definitely. Jan Berger, as you know, put out a report on IS's online activities on Twitter in particular. And he's talked about how, in many ways, this network has been degraded over time since he first collected that data in September 2014, about 15 months ago now. I was wondering, in your research and what you've been looking at, whether you've noticed that the American online scene has shrunk or degraded, or what is the state of it now compared to, say, a year ago when the IS network overall was larger too?
Yeah, I think it's a fair assessment to say it's shrunk a bit. We started this project about 6 months ago, and it's a lot of a cat and mouse game. So you have a number of individuals that were very prominent when we first started, and they haven't come back on, or when they come back on, they have one third of their followers there. So I absolutely agree with you. The issue when you talk about the online space, and we have a team of researchers that are, you know, following this on a regular basis, is you're constantly trying to figure out who the new accounts are and where they're linked to. And it's a very difficult game to say. I would agree with JM violently that the scene has shrunk considerably. There's also been kind of a shift away from Twitter a little bit. We've seen a prominent number of a good number of homegrown violent extremists who are essentially moving from Twitter over to Tumblr and other platforms because they want to essentially own the space a little bit more. You can personalize a blog and things like that a little bit more than you can Twitter. And they're essentially tired of having to be suspended 30 or 40 times. And so they're looking for a place that they can kind of keep their head up for a few days.
Have you noticed that they've gone over to Telegram at all also, since that's sort of been in some ways where the official media of IS, as well as some other groups, have now turned to, especially in the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 months?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, cool. Returning to the real world, since that's important too, as we know, historically we have seen, a bunch of clusters in the U.S., you know, New York, Boston, areas in Florida in the early 90s. Virginia in the early 2000s, Minneapolis in the latter half of the decade. I was wondering, if we could drill down more into some of the clusters going on now. What do we see now? And what's similar and what's different than what we saw in the past?
Yeah, I mean, we do see clusters. Again, compared to the European setting, it's everything is somewhat similar, but on a much smaller scale. But we do see these clusters forming, on a different basis. Minneapolis, for example, is more on an ethnic and neighborhood basis. It's basically Somalis that come from the same neighborhood and know each other from right from school, from very, very related and so on. So that's that cluster has basically been there for the last 10 years. Different players, but kind of a lot of common traits. We've seen the Bosnian case, which is fascinating because it's the link to the hometown, even though they're spread throughout the country. We have sort of a bit of a core in St. Louis, but then spread throughout the country. We have seen other clusters that form not based on any kind of ethnic bond. And I think there was one that was very interesting in New York, in the greater New York area, where you had a couple of them were related, were brothers. One was a convert, was a high school classmate of one of them, and somebody else they knew it from university, and a couple of other people kind of they got to know in some way. And of course, the social media also plays a role, but they are mostly in the physical space. We have seen a couple of cases of study groups that form around mosques and then take sort of a different form of like private gatherings and private study groups scattered throughout the country. I think the dynamic is, I would say, still a lot of individuals. And I think, again, the big role that the FBI plays in that, having that very aggressive, preemptive role of doing the sting operations, in some cases prevents the formation of these clusters. Because these are individuals who are spasmodically trying to find like-minded individuals, and in some cases the FBI that presents itself as that other like-minded individual and prevents the formation of clusters. What we see is that they tend to be less connected to the real deal, to the organizations operating overseas. The clusters you mentioned, like Florida in the early 90s, Virginia, the paintball jihad guys and so on, all these clusters had managed to some degree to form a link to Al-Qaeda, to Lashkar-e-Taiba, to a variety of other groups. I think here we're seeing a bit more of a struggle for these clusters to form that those ties with ISIS. They try, in most cases, they do try, but it's only, I would say, anecdotal when they actually manage to establish those ties.
Yeah, definitely. So just to wrap this up here a little bit, since I think we've covered all the main points, unless you think I've missed something. I was wondering, you know, looking forward, obviously it's impossible to predict stuff, and I won't be like, what's going to be happening in 5 or 10 years, since that's impossible to know. But, you know, based off of what you're seeing now in this report and everything, where's this all going in the near term? What do you see the trajectories, and how do you see this evolving maybe in the next 6 to 18 months in the U.S. context?
Yeah, I think what happens in Syria and Iraq will determine what happens in terms of our homegrown jihadists and the prominent role in that. It'll be interesting to see, and I don't know if this is – the jury's still out on whether this is a shift, but a number of the folks we were looking at, you know, are mentioned online that they, you know, they can't travel or they don't have the finances to travel, and so supporters are encouraging them to do what they can while they're here. It'll be interesting to see if the shift goes away from trying to travel to Syria and Iraq and more towards the homegrown kind of traditional domestic plotting that we've seen in the past.
Yeah, and that's a message that has been coming also from, I'm reluctant to call it ISIS Central, but from nodes in Syria and Iraq, not just to Americans, but to Westerners in general. The general message is no longer come here, but it's mostly stay home and do things at home. What exactly that entails for Americans. And again, the FBI said a few months ago that we've seen over the summer a decline in the number of people traveling. Whether this is all connected or it has to do with aggressive law enforcement, smaller numbers, it's all very difficult to say. But that's sort of the trajectory. Less people traveling, more people staying here. What that's going to mean over the next few months, it's very difficult to say.
Yeah, I think part of it too is just it's more difficult to get to Syria now also, in terms of getting through Turkey. And then also, you know, they have lost a little bit on the ground, at least in the Iraqi context. So
It will be interesting to see if any of our homegrown jihadists decide to go to different areas besides Syria and Iraq, whether they...
Libya.
Have you seen any Libyan... No. Yeah, because there have been already a few in the UK and France, but that's obviously closer and easier probably.
We have seen a few Americans, you know, mention Libya and how it's the next front, but nobody's, you know, actively trying to find... We haven't seen people actively trying to find recruiters to get over there. But, I mean, the jury's still out on it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks for coming out to the show today, guys, and sharing your new findings with everyone.
Thank you. Thanks, Aaron.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover postings from November 30th through December 7th.
During that time span, 6 foreign fighters were announced killed by the Islamic State in Iraq, while 8 foreign fighters were announced killed by various groups in Syria. And also during this time, AQAP announced 9 military operations.
On November 30th, Ansar al-Islam established a Sharia course in Syria.
On December 1st, Harakat Ahrar al-Sham al-Islamiyya cleans roads in Idlib, Syria.
Also on December 1st, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State reaps the potato and turnip harvest.
On December 2nd, Wilayat Tarablus of the Islamic State puts on a Dawah forum in Sirte, Libya.
On December 2nd as well, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State builds new shops in al-Mahlabiyya village, Iraq.
On December 3rd, Wilayat Khorasan of the Islamic State burns drugs in Nangarhar, Afghanistan.
On December 3rd as well, Wilayat al-Fallujah of the Islamic State graduates a new class from its Sheikh Abu Hamza al-Muhajir military training camp.
Also on the 3rd, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State shows off its veterinary clinic in Mosul, Iraq.
On December 4th, Wilayat Halab of the Islamic State shows off its winter military clothing sewing workshop.
Also on the 4th, Wilayat Halab of the Islamic State begins building the Abdullah bin Umar Mosque in Al-Bab, Syria.
On December 5th, Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen Darna puts on an entertainment forum for children.
On December 6th, Jabhat al-Nusra graduates a new class from its Sharia Institute in Jabal Turkman, Syria.
And finally, on December 6th as well, Jabhat al-Nusra lays new sewer drains in Salakin, Syria. If you have any feedback, you can email us, podcast@jihadology.net, or find us on Twitter, where we are @jihadpod. If you're a fan of the show, please consider checking out the Patreon page, which we've linked to in the show notes. And a big thanks to all the people who are currently supporting us on Patreon, especially Hakan Jar. We greatly appreciate your support. As always, the show is available on Stitcher and iTunes, and if you use one of those platforms to listen to the program, please take a moment to rate and review it, which will help more people discover the podcast.
Thanks everyone for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Lorenzo and Seamus for coming onto the show and sharing their expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster Carl Moran for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. Until next time, I'm out.